You are about to witness history in the making. Despite the world's highest living standards, the average American remained vaguely discontent, aware that his goal of a better way of life had still not been fully realized. There was something missing.
There's this awful gap in our lives just because we don't have... Oh, but why talk about it?
It's just that... Oh, I keep hoping someone can find a way to...
Don't be a fool, Mary. You know that's impossible.
Oh, I know. It's just that...
Gad, it's ironic. With all our technology and industrial know-how, we still don't have the one thing that could give us a better way of life.
It's the Forgotten Filmcast.
Did you ever feel as if you've been left out? Well, that's when it really hurts. When no one understands that you'd do a good job if you had a chance.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 204 of the Forgotten Filmcast. My name is Todd Liebenow, and thanks for joining me for this look at the movies that time forgot. On this episode, I'll be joined by Toby Rohn from The Hannibal Eight to discuss a 1955 film about a bunch of teenage hooligans who are actually played by actors all in their late 20s, starring Tommy Cook, Molly McCart, and Sue England, directed by Fred F. Sears. It's Teenage Crime Wave. But first...
Here, take a puff on mine.
No thanks, Rose.
Oh, go ahead.
Say, have you heard about...
The Forgotten Film Cast.
Good evening, folks, and a hearty welcome to our drive-in theater. We have a wonderful evening's entertainment lined up for you, one that will provide several hours of pleasurable relaxation and diversion for you and your family. Did you fail to dress up for tonight's show? No tie, an old shirt and slacks, a house dress? Well, don't give it a thought. We're glad you came as you are. We just want you to enjoy yourselves. Don't forget to visit our refreshment center during the intermission or any time. You love the tasty array of snacks we have to offer. So will the youngsters. Everything is quality and so good. We hope you'll make this a weekly visit. Bring the family. Bring your friends. There are always wonderful new pictures to see, delightful snacks to nibble, a gay, pleasant evening for all. Oh, a word of caution. Don't drive over 10 miles an hour in the theater area for your safety's sake. And Mom or Pop, go with the kids when they leave the car. We hope you have a wonderful time. Come back soon. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We're happy to announce that we've installed Burns-O-Matic in-car heaters for your comfort and pleasure. When you receive your heater, you'll find it very easy to place in your car. Just roll down your front window and rest the heater's bracket on the window with the cylinder on the outside of the car. Roll up your window securely as far as it will go to hold the heater firmly in position. For maximum results, tilt the face of the heater towards the windshield and sit back and enjoy the show in healthful comfort. With these modern, safe, efficient in-car heaters, this drive-in theater will now remain open all year round. If you have any further questions about your Burns-O-Matic in-car heater, please contact one of our theater attendants. And remember, This drive-in theater will now remain open all year round, regardless of the weather.
Drive away your worries and cares at this drive-in theater, where you will see the finest motion pictures of all time soon to be released. Drama, comedy, adventure, excitement, something for everyone. Here's a brief glimpse of some of the truly fine pictures we've scheduled in the near future.
Once a normal, voluptuously beautiful woman, she drove into a nightmare of horror and saw descending from the sky a titanic monster whose fearsome touch became a frightful curse.
You think I'm drunk, don't you? All of you! I'm not drunk! I'm not! You've got to believe me!
Please.
It was right in the middle of the highway, 30 feet tall!
Once she's in the booby hatch, throw the key away. That'll put you in the driver's seat. You'd make a wild driver, Harry. With $50 million.
What she saw was beyond belief until others, too, faced its hideous, uncontrollable menace. Attack of the 50-foot woman, incredibly huge, with incredible desires for love and vengeance.
Cosmic phantom, this being, boneless, fleshless, almost invisible, stalking the earth, leaving panic behind.
Kathy, what is it? What's wrong?
In there, it was horrible.
There's our cosmic man. Like a solid mass, and yet he's not solid. Like a creature made of matter, and yet more like antimatter.
This sphere from outer space, impervious to heat, impossible to move. Was it a satellite sent to spy on Earth? A spaceship? A secret weapon? Science was baffled. The Army, ready to accept the challenge.
Radio the base. Have every available man stationed around those atomic plants.
I am here, in the darkness.
I demand you state your business here.
And now, on with the show.
You might as well snap out of it, kid. You're in for a while and it isn't going to get any easier. All you've got is a year. Me, I knew I'd had it when I walked into that court.
Look, kid, I like you. You know that. You could have given the cops a lot more information than you did.
Don't touch me.
What's the matter? You afraid you might catch something? Get this through your head. In jail, nobody's better than anybody else. And you won't have your mother and father to fight for you either. You're going to learn to listen to me when I talk to you.
I said don't touch me! And if you think anybody fights my battles, try me and see.
You little crook.
Now, what'd you call me?
Pull
me a trap, why don't you?
I might have known you'd be the one. Who started this?
Well, two of a kind. I don't want any more trouble, Marsh. We've got ways of cooling you off. And that's where you'd go right now if they weren't taking you out of here tomorrow. So settle down.
ladies.
Okay, our movie this time is Teenage Crime Wave from 1955. And joining me to discuss this film is Toby Rohn from the Hannibal 8. Toby, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Todd. Thanks. Great to be here. It's always good to be here.
It's always great to have you on the show. I think you and I are on similar wavelengths when it comes to our movie tastes, so it's always great to have you on the show. Why don't you take a moment here, tell everybody a little bit about yourself and what you do over there on your sites.
Okay. Well, I have two blogs. One that's 50swesterns.com, which is kind of obvious what it's about. And my second one is the Hannibal 8, which is over at, it's a WordPress site. And it basically is movies that I like that aren't Westerns. So there's lots of 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s films, usually genre films. I like movies where people either get shot or eaten. So that's kind of what they are. So I've written a book on One Eye Jacks. I do movie DVD, Blu-ray commentary things every once in a while. And that's pretty much it.
Well, that's it, but it's a lot. You do a lot of stuff. There's always interesting things going on your blogs. I always got to say, I love the name of your one blog, The Hannibal 8, just because, as you know, I love that movie too, The Great Race.
Yep.
It's great to always be reminded of that there. But yeah, I just am always blown away by just the wide variety of stuff that you've got going on. And one of the big things that I appreciate about your site is that you're one of those folks that is always shedding light on the things that are coming out in physical media and, letting us know about the things that I wouldn't be aware of otherwise. So, I mean, with us in the holiday season now, as we're recording this, I got to ask you about, what are the things that you've come across here that I should be putting on my gift list? Because you've always got ideas out there and, you find those gems that I didn't know were being released. So what are some of the cool releases you've come across here lately?
Well, first of all, I'm glad to be known as an evangelist for physical media because, the whole deal with the French Connection with the line edited out of it whenever you watch it streaming, that alone is just, we just can't have that. So I'm all about physical media. But anyway, there's a new company out called Film Masters. I don't know if you're aware of them. And they are taking old B-movies. Most of them, I think, so far have been pretty much public domain movies. And they're doing an incredible job with them. And they're focusing these days on a lot of Roger Corman stuff, The Terror, Little Shop of Horrors, Ski Troop Attack, things like that. And they're just taking these cheesy little grade B movies and they're giving them the Cadillac treatment. And they're wonderful. And so I can't say enough about those guys. That would be my pick these days because they're just terrific. They've just done a great job with them. And I love those kinds of movies. I grew up watching junk like Killer Shrews and Giant Gila Monster and The Terror, things like that. So it's just great to see them looking perfect again.
Well, and it's wonderful to look into the Corman stuff. I mean, Corman just always intrigues me. I mean, both as a producer and as a director. I mean, it's very easy to kind of put Corman into this category of B movies and just say, he's all about, making a profit or whatever. And I mean, yeah, the guy knew how to make a buck, but he also just had a wonderful touch when it comes to these films.
Absolutely. He's very, very underrated as a director. Very, very so much so.
Oh yeah. And I mean, there's some stuff that you can watch of his where it's like, okay, well they ran it through the assembly line there's not as much flair there, but there's other things that you come across and you just go, wow, this guy was just getting as much as he could out of every dollar he was spending.
Yep.
I mean, especially Absolutely. If you look at like the Poe films are there's ones that always come to mind there with that. Like, I just can't say enough about his one film. I think it's the one he always says is his only film that didn't make a profit, but it's just incredible. And that, of course, is The Intruder with
awesome.
William Shatner. It's an amazing movie.
That's probably the best performance William Shatner ever gave. That's a great movie. That is a great movie.
It's one that I had heard about for years and years and never gotten to see. And it was back in the early days of streaming. I think it popped up on Netflix, believe it or not. And
wow.
I was blown away.
Yep. Yep, I'm a huge fan of those Poe movies, particularly Pit in the Pendulum and Tomb of Ligeia. Those are my two favorites, and I just love them. They're great, and the everything from the color effects to the use of the widescreen to, you know, like you said, you know, just squeezing every bit of production value you can out of the tiny bit of money you have. That's as good as B movie making gets, I think.
Well, and plus you've got the likes of like Vincent Price, I mean, giving it all he's got in a bunch of those movies, you know.
Oh, they're great. They're great. You know, I used to work with a woman. She was probably about 10 years older than me. And she was telling me about when she was in high school, going to the drive-in. I think she lived in Ohio. And they ran all of those Vincent Price, Corman, Poe things back to back at the drive-in all night long. And I was thinking, man, I would kill to have been at that thing. That must have been so awesome.
Oh, that sounds like a great night, I tell you.
But she said, but I think, thinking about it, you'd probably realize how repetitive they are. It doesn't make them not great, but they do borrow a lot of things, and the some of the sets are probably...
I was going to say, including the sets, you know, yeah.
And that same, you know, the shot of the castle with the waves crashing on the rocks in front of it. I'm sure that that's probably used in every one, but so what?
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, each one of those films, I mean, yeah, again, it, you know, Corman's doing what he can to get the most out of his money, but each one of those is a full meal, you know. It just has so much that you could just get behind and just enjoy yourself. They're not, you know, he doesn't overstay his welcome with those movies. They're a nice, manageable size, and they're as entertaining as heck. Yeah, they are.
I love them. Now I'm gonna probably get off here and go watch Pit in the Pendulum. Oh, yeah. They're just great. I grew up when I was a kid. We had a 16 millimeter CinemaScope print of Pit in the Pendulum. And I would come home from school and watch it almost every single day. So my friend James, who lived down the street, would come over and we would watch Pit in the Pendulum over and over and over.
That's fantastic.
I love that one.
Well, what about in the realm of the Westerns? I mean, you know, you have a great love for the Westerns. Is there anything big that's been coming out here in the physical media?
Yeah, if you're a 4K kind of guy, I am not yet. I have a player and a TV, but I just haven't really dove into it. But Rio Bravo with John Wayne, Howard Hawks, 1959, that is out on 4K. It has been restored. And that was a movie that never looked very good on home video. And so I have not seen it. I've heard it's very nice, but that's out there. And it's not, the restoration is not coming on Blu-ray. It is 4K only, which is kind of a drag. But that one's out. That's a great one. But there has not been a lot of Western stuff lately. I just recorded a commentary for one that has not really been announced yet. So I can't say anything about it. But that'll be after the first of the year. And if you like these things, Classic Flicks is going to eventually launch a series of the Hopalong Cassidy films. There's 60-something of those. So put all of those out, and I've done a commentary for one of those from the will be the first volume of those.
Oh, awesome.
So there's a little, there's not a whole lot. I mean, monster movies and stuff like that, and film noir and crime pictures and stuff, there's a lot bigger audience for those. So that's why we get those on DVD and Blu-ray and not as many Westerns. So it's a shame.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's get on with our movie we have here today. It is definitely one of those that fits into the crime movie category. From 1955, this is Teenage Crime Wave. And I got to say first, to start things off here, when we were talking about, you know, what movie are we going to discuss this time, you threw out some possibilities for me. I had a hard time finding Teenage Crime Wave because of the spelling. The spelling is unique. It is, yeah, for folks that follow along at home that are trying to find these things, and I will tell you, it's actually easy to find and watch right now because it's on Tubi, which is the, I keep on saying, the best place for finding a lot of these kind of movies right now. But if you're trying to find this movie, it is spelled teen-age and then crime-wave. Teenage Crime Wave. So basically you have two words in the title and neither one of them they got right. You know, I never would have thought to smell it that way. Anyway, it's so yeah, it's produced by Sam Katzman. We should say that we know we both have a fondness for Mr. Katzman. It's directed by Fred F. Sears, an actor turned director, directed just a ton of films, basically between 1946 and 1957 when he passed away. He had at least five films released posthumously in 1958.
Yep.
This guy was so busy. So yeah, Toby, I know you've got a lot of information on Mr. Sears. I want to let you share before we get into the movie itself.
Okay. Well, Fred Sears is one of my favorites of the B-movie guys. And the fact that he made good movies produced by Sam Katzman is a really good indicator of how good he really was, because he definitely was handicapped. But he started out, he directed, you know, theater and stuff like that. And he ended up in Hollywood, and he worked as like a just a bit player, you know, bad guy kind of thing in a lot of the Durango Kid movies. And then he started working as a dialogue director on them. And then the next thing you knew, he was directing them. And sometimes he was directing them, and he'd direct one and he would be in the next one. And then sometimes he would direct them and be in them. So he really was in a lot of the later Durango Kid movies. And the Durango Kid, they were all made for Columbia. They're low-budget B-Westerns, you know, pretty much aimed at kids. But they usually had a lot of action in them, and he did a great job with them. So he did some of those. And after that, he sort of joined Sam Katzman's unit there at Columbia and started making all kinds of things. And a lot of his movies are just well-made schlocky B movies, like, I'm not gonna lie to you. But then every once in a while, like a lot of those guys, they were real pros, they knew what they were doing. But when they got a really good script, they made something that was really good. And he made a handful of westerns that are really good. He worked with there was a guy named McDonald, who was another producer at Columbia, and he usually spent a little bit more money on his movies than Katzman did. So he made some westerns for him, but they're quite good. But for Katzman, he made a picture called The Werewolf from 1956 that is excellent. It's a little bit of a different take on the whole werewolf thing. It's very well done. The guy who plays the werewolf, I can't remember his name, he does a great job. It's just a really good movie. He did some others that are pretty good. He did The Notorious Giant Claw, yes. The movie with the horrible monster that looks like a turkey or something that got emaciated turkey. He did that one, which if the movie had decent special effects, it would have been a pretty good, you know, late 50s, you know, B-horror movie, science fiction film. So he did that one. But he did a lot of stuff. He did a picture called Chicago Syndicate, which was one of Katzman's things, who was trying to cash in on not everybody paying attention to some of the organized crime stuff, the trials and things that were going on there in the mid-50s. Katzman was great about grabbing a hold of a trend or spotting a trend and jumping on it and making a movie about it as quick as he could. Teenage delinquency stuff is what Teenage Crime Wave came from. You know, it's one of those ideas of ripped from the headlines. So, right. You know, they say that Sam Katzman is the person who came up with the word beatnik when he was doing something to cash in on the whole, you know, the whole beat craze. So he had it going on. He made some of the first, you know, counterculture hippie movies in the late 60s or mid to late 60s. He was on top of all that stuff. And so this is perfect for it. You know, it's the juvenile delinquency stuff of the mid 50s. He made some of the first rock and roll movies. Don't Knock the Rock and Rock Around the Clock with Bill Haley in the Comets. Don't Knock the Rock also has Little Richard in it. Little Richard, of course, steals the whole show. In the early 60s, he made a thing called Hootenanny Hoot with the folk craze, you know, from the early 60s. So, I mean, Katzman was on top of that stuff. But anyway, Fred Sears made a ton of movies. He worked himself to death, literally. He died in his office at Columbia Pictures in 1957. And like you said, he had a handful of movies waiting to be released. He almost always worked for Columbia. He made a few outside Columbia. But, you know, he's one of those guys that if he had ever got a decent schedule and a decent budget, he could have made a really good movie. I mean, he did make really good movies for what he was, for what he worked with.
There are some gems in there for sure. I mean, the one that, as I look through his filmography, that my eye goes right to is, of course, Earth versus the Flying Saucers.
Oh, yeah, that's awesome.
Is a tremendous movie. It, of course, got Ray Harryhausen's hand on it as well. And, he's the name that comes up the most when you talk about that film. But, got to give Sears some credit on that. I mean, it is a really well put together, fun, and intriguing piece of 50s sci-fi. So, yeah, I got to give a shout out to that one.
That's a great one. Harryhausen's, a lot of his movies were cool anyway. But, his movies made them cool. That's just a good movie in addition to being cool. Because some of the Harryhausen movies are, he's the sole reason you would watch it. But that's a good movie. There's a Western that Sears made I want to mention. It's hard to find. It's called Fury at Gunsight Pass from 1956. It's only like an hour and 5 minutes long or something like that. It is terrific. It is one of those movies that just packs one double cross and plot twist after another on top of it. It's really, really good. That's probably my favorite of all his films. Mm.
That one's adding great to my watch list here for sure. Well, let's get on with this one. So this film, it begins with a young girl named Terry, played by Molly McCart. And she is in a bar catching the attention of a man who is way too old for her, and she convinces him to take her out, and they head out onto the street. Now Terry is actually a part of a gang where she basically hooks the fish, and then there's these two guys who jump out and they rob the guy. Okay, so now it happens that the two guys on this night happen to have with them an innocent girl named Jane, played by Sue England, and she is simply out on a blind date with one of them. And as we're introduced to them, one of them's getting a little bit too handsy in the back of the car, and she's like, "Hey, take me home. I don't want to do this." But these guys are like, "Okay, here he comes," and so they go out and they rob this guy that Terry has hooked for them. Now, long story short, the robbery goes bad and the guys run off, but both Terry and this innocent girl Jane are caught, and both of them end up being sent to a reform school. I think they actually called it an industrial school
in the movie.
Which I was like, I'm not sure what that means, but anyway, they send them off even though Jane was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. Doesn't matter. They're like, "Hey, you were there. You're getting locked up." So the two girls end up being transported to this facility where they're going to be, but they don't make it very far. They end up having Terry's boyfriend, Mike, who's played by Tommy Cook. He was one of the guys in the car there that night. He comes and he busts them out. He actually shoots and kills a deputy in the process. And now poor Jane has no choice but to go along with Terry and Mike. Otherwise, they may kill her, too. Now, eventually, these three end up at a farmhouse owned by an elderly couple. They're named the Grants. James Bell and Kay Reel play them. And the trigger-happy Mike decides that, they're going to stay there, and they're going to wait for their buddy who's going to come and pick them up and move them to safer ground and all that. But things get more complicated because the old couple is expecting a visit from their ex-military son, Ben, played by Frank Griffin, who has been off at college. And yeah, so it becomes kind of a tense situation where they're all locked up in the farmhouse trying to figure out how to survive and how the bad guys are going to get away. Now, this film, it was actually featured on an episode of Mystery Science Theater 3000, but I'm going to say right off the bat here, I think this is a way more polished film than many of the ones you're going to see on that show. Exactly. But I'm going to let Toby get us started here. Give us a few of your thoughts on Teenage Crime Wave.
There's a bunch of stuff with this one. One, it's one of the only movies that I know of, other than The Plymouth Adventure, that's set at Thanksgiving. There are not many Thanksgiving movies, and it's a shame we didn't do this last week. It could have been done just for Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
So it's at Thanksgiving. We don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves, but the end of it takes place at Griffith Park right around the same time that Rebel Without a Cause had a big scene at Griffith Park with the teenage gangs. So there's a little, did they rip off one? I mean, I don't know. I haven't done the chicken or the egg on that
one. Sometimes I feel like Griffith Park Observatory is the most used location in all of Los Angeles for movies, because
it seems like it, doesn't it?
Rebel Without a Cause, and I think, isn't it Amazing Colossal Man? Doesn't that have a sequence there? You know, there's just a bunch of movies that they always seem to end up at Griffith Park Observatory, which, I mean, it's a great location. I get it, but, you know.
It's a great one. They've got a great Country Squire station wagon in it that the deputy is driving them to prison in. I always admire that. The dialogue for the kids, especially Tommy Cook's and Molly McCart's dialogue as the two, you know, delinquents here, is terrific. They just have so many great things to say. You know, guns are heaters and, you know, all that kind of cool lingo. I love that stuff. But it basically is teenagers at Thanksgiving, and it's The Desperate Hours with Humphrey Bogart, if you know that one.
Yeah.
That's pretty much what this is. It's take the juvenile delinquents and stick them in Desperate Hours. And it is surprisingly effective. And it's got, but this is the one of the great classic B-movie setups, which is take a small cast, stick them in a single place, so you don't have to have a lot of sets, a lot of money on sets, you don't have to do a lot of traveling or anything. And then you just build tension within this one space. And so they, you know, this has been done time and time again, this sort of setup. And they do a great job with it. You know, Sears knew what he was doing.
Yeah, I thought this was a pretty solid 50s teen crime flick, even if the title is pretty misleading. Because
that's true, it is.
There's not really a crime wave going on here. I mean, it's really all wrapped around one main crime, and it's also kind of borderline to call these people teenagers. These are the oldest looking teenagers this side of Dear Evan Hansen. You know, it's just,
they never can get this right. My daughter and I have been making our way through the old Twin Peaks show, the first two seasons of it. And those, you know, we never could figure out how to make teenagers actually teenagers. You know, let's put 25, 30 year olds in there and hope for the best. So, but these, and the cast in this is pretty good. I mean, Tommy Cook is pretty over the top, but his part kind of calls for him to be a psycho. Molly McCartney, cool, and Sue England is cool. One of the things I thought was interesting is they take the two girls to the reform school, they put them in that line to make them all take showers, and then they go to their room and they have on like silk nightgowns. Did you know that? Yeah.
Well, the first 15 minutes or so of this movie, first of all, it plays with you because it keeps kind of shifting what kind of movie you think this is going to be. But they cram into that beginning of the film so many different, just the things that you need to have in various genres of exploitation films from the 50s. I mean, when it starts out, you think, okay, so this is going to be, you know, a film about teenage delinquents that are out hooking these guys and robbing them and all that stuff. And then it shifts pretty quickly because they get caught right away. And then you think, okay, this is going to be a girls in prison movie. And, right. You know, And I mean, when we're in that moment, and it's only a couple of minutes that we're in this mode, but they do hit on a bunch of the things that they always have in girls' prison movies. have a nasty warden, you get a shower scene, you get the girls hanging around in their underwear scene, and then you get a cat fight on top of it all.
That's right.
And then it shifts again, and it becomes like a Young Hoods on the Lam type of movie. And then, you know, eventually it becomes a home invasion thing, The Desperate Hours. So, right. You know, just in the first 15 minutes or so of this movie, it shifts genres a couple of times.
Yeah, it does. I hadn't really thought about it. It does, but it really does. And you're like you said, it checks all the boxes for each one of those, right? Every time it pretends to be something else, it checks all the boxes. Like you said, the women's prison, got to have the shower, got to have the underwear, got to have the cat fight. Okay, now we can move on to the next thing. But it's funny. What's funny is even though it does that, once it settles down and gets down to business, it's a solid film. So it's really weird. This is one of those where they could kind of have their cake and eat it too, you know? They made a really good movie while doing all the required things that a movie that was going to run at the drive-in that a bunch of teenagers were going to go watch, it had to have all those things, and it did. But they still ended up making a pretty real movie out of it before it was all said and done. One of the screenwriters was Harry Essex, he wrote The Creature from the Black Lagoon, and it came from outer space a year or two before this. So, you know, he's no slouch.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I like a lot of the elements that come into play when we kind of settle into the story of this home invasion type of a thing. Just the dynamic going on between the teenage crooks, the one girl that's kind of the innocent in all of it, and then this elderly couple. You know, it works out pretty well. I actually will say, though, it was a little weird that the character that in the beginning of the film we think is going to be the lead really kind of ends up being moved to the background. And I'm talking, of course, about the character of Jane, played by Sue England. I mean, when the movie starts, we think this is going to be all about this innocent girl. She's in the wrong place at the wrong time. She ends up, you know, getting sent off to prison and then busted out, and she's tied up with these crooks and she doesn't want to be, but you know, she's now on this path and she can't do anything about it. Yeah, I thought that was going to be the direction the movie goes, but really once they get into the house, she really moves to the background more, and it really focuses primarily on Molly McCart and Tommy Cook. And you know, it was kind of like, you know, oh, well, what happened to Jane? I thought this was her story.
I remember, I've seen this lots of times recently, but I always kind of thought originally that Sue England was going to sort of do the slow burn, and then she was gonna, you know, she or the Grant's son, who was, you know, visiting for Thanksgiving, that they were gonna, you know, organize something, that they were going to do it, but it didn't work out that way. But I mean, I kept thinking that they were going to hatch some sort of plan, but that wasn't the way it worked out. And I think that what's interesting, this is one of those movies that plays with your head, where when someone shows up at the house, like the neighbor who wants to borrow the seed catalog, or the cops who show up, it plays with you, because you one hand, you want the Grants to get rescued, but at the same time, you don't want the crooks to get caught. It's kind of got, you got this dual thing going, where they've played with you enough that you don't know which side you're on anymore.
Well, that one scene you mentioned in particular with the neighbor is, I like that scene a lot. I mean, basically, first of all, this neighbor is just incredibly nosy.
Yes, he is. Yes,
no matter how many times he calls and they say, no, don't come over. He comes over anyway. But the way that the scene plays out, I mean, I think this is one of the scenes you can really point to in this movie that shows what a skilled director Sears was, because they're playing with different elements there, where we've got the crooks are in the room with the wife. You know, they're listening in. You've got the old man and his son there, and the neighbor comes in and he's got a shotgun, and he just presents it to the son, to Ben, because he's like, something's going wrong with it. I wanted you to take a look at it. You know about these things from the war and all that. And you're just going, oh my gosh, here's the opportunity. Here's the open door. You know, what's going to happen? And it's just a sequence that works really well in building the tension and such.
Well, so they do that repeatedly. There's several scenes through. I mean, it's only, an hour and 15 minutes or something.
Yeah.
But they build towards something and then let the pressure off. And they build to something else. And, you know, lots of movies do that. But this does it repeatedly and does it well. So it's really a roller coaster ride, because it just takes you up and then drops you, and takes something else up and drops you. And then when it finally ends, I find the end is a shock to me. The way it plays out is different too. So, I mean, it's just, I don't know. It just, I think what I love about B movies is I love the ones where, because of the writing, the acting, directing, whatever it is, they rise above the norm and they zig when everybody else would have zagged. And this one does that, you know, it does. It takes you somewhere and then it does something different. So you think it's going to be really predictable, and surprisingly isn't, is that it gets to those points where you expect this to happen, but they do something different.
Well, I do want to talk a bit about the cast members and their performances here in a moment. But before we do that, I wanted to hit on something that I think is one of the intriguing elements of this film. This is one of those films that falls into that category where it's like they're wanting to put all this stuff on the screen, you know, all this crime, all this bad behavior from these teenagers and such. But they're doing it under the guise of being like a cautionary tale, which is something that, yep, you know, you would see in B movies and exploitation films going way back even before this, where, you know, their excuse for showing a lot of exploitative things in the movies was, well, we're doing it under this umbrella of, you know, don't let this be you. You know, it's a message, yeah, movie, something like that.
Yeah.
And this movie,
notorious for that.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, this movie really frames that. I mean, you know, it has this opening text crawl, you know, that's kind of talking about how this could happen in any city in America, blah, 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 that whole type of thing. But then there's all these little things sprinkled throughout this film that, you know, are those ways where they're trying to give themselves legitimacy, or, you know, trying to present the wholesome side of things, you know, where, you know, there's very much this thread of, like, you know, traditional family values going through things, because this family that they invade the home of, you know, they're this down to earth, they're farmers, they are, you know, this loving family. They've got a son who's gone off and served in the military and now is back on stateside, and he's going to college and bettering himself and all that kind of stuff. And like, there's the scene where the old woman is talking with Terry, Molly McCord's character, and it is like, you know, do you know your way around the kitchen? You should be able to do this, you know, kind of instilling those values of what a woman, right, should do, what a wife should do. And you know, there's moments where, like, the old man is reading the Bible out loud, right, while the right, criminal's sitting there and all that stuff. So yeah, I wanted to get your take on that side of things. You know, I guess, how does this film do with kind of trying to give itself that legitimacy alongside all of this, you know, nasty behavior from the teenagers?
That was a big thing in the 50s was, we're going to show you all this stuff that we normally wouldn't be able to get away with because we're making a message film here, or we're trying to show a problem that needs to be addressed. That's Katzman's organized crime movies do that. It's that same, you know, this is a serious expose of something that's going on here in this country. And then they're going to show you all kinds of killings and, you know, all sorts of depraved behavior. And it's great. And they did, that was a lot of, you know, they're perfect at that. And one of the things I thought was interesting, I've always said, is I really love the Grants. They are kind of presented as this cornball, you know, down-to-earth farmer family living in this little house. And there is a scene where he reads the Bible to himself, the dad does, all that stuff. But the actors are so good that they elevate it, because it could have been really stupid. But I think it works because they're really great. And I think it does. That's something that happens in throughout this one, is I think that the acting kind of pulls it back from getting a little too goofy. And I like the fact that, you know, I thought it's cool the way the mom, Mrs. Grant, is doing that kind of stuff, trying to, you know, she can't help trying to come to Terry's aid. You know, she really wants to help her out.
Right. Right.
Such a great woman, but of course it falls on deaf ears. And I love the dialogue. Some of the dialogue is the dad, Mr. Grant, is reading the Bible, and Tommy Cook asks him why he reads the Bible, and he says that it gives him peace of mind. And of course Tommy Cook holds up his pistol and says, you know, this is what gives me, this is my peace of mind, you know, all that kind of cornball stuff. But it's great. But this has one of my all-time favorite lines from one of these kinds of movies, is Jane says to Terry, because Terry's kind of got her eye on the Grant's son, and she says, "You're dirt, Terry. He never touched me." I just love it. Terry.
Well, that's a great dynamic that develops through the film too, where, you know, clearly both of these young women have their eye on the son of the Grants.
Yes.
And, you know, that's causing friction. And not to mention that there's friction between the son, Ben, and Tommy Cook's character as well. I want to jump back to the parents real quick here. One of the things I love about the old couple too, and this goes back to what you're saying about how the acting elevates it. I don't know how much of this is the script and how much of this is just the delivery of the actors, But they're saying all these things to the criminals that are meant to be uplifting and, you know, their attempt to save them, you know, so to speak, and to instill in them the good family values and all that. At the same time, though, you get the impression that really what's going on here is that these two are twisting the knife and that they're like, you know, going, you're pathetic. And here's all the reasons why. And it's just getting to these two criminal characters all the more as things go on.
Right. And so then it becomes, are they twisting the knife? Are they being subtle with it? Or is it that they really mean it, but because these two have been, you know, dogged by this kind of stuff all their life, that it's just, they're at the last straw, you know, it's like, mm-hmm. this is just too, these people are too good. And, I don't know. It's just fun. I don't know. It kind of sounds like we're making it sound hokier than it actually is. But I guess that's what's good about it, is how it avoids crossing that line. It comes pretty close a few times.
Well, we're probably making it sound loftier than you know, than Sam Katzman ever intended. You know what
that
I mean? I mean,
be true. That is entirely true.
Well, let's talk a bit about our cast here and kind of what they deliver. I don't know. I guess I'll let you start. I mean, who do you think stands out here when it comes to the cast?
Well, I think Tommy Cook's a little over the top, but I think it was written that way. So, you know, maybe he was note perfect and I'm just giving him a hard time.
I agree that he's over the top. it works. It works for what we've got going on here and what type of movie we're in. He just seems on the edge all the time. He never really comes down from that, which, you know, kind of doesn't make him feel terribly human, but it does make for an entertaining villain. I will say that I really thought it was interesting just how Tommy Cook is not a terribly large person, shall we say.
No.
He's very small compared to the other people, especially Ben, the son, who is really large and intimidating compared to him. And Tommy Kirk, you know, he's just always holding. I said Tommy Kirk, Tommy Cook. I knew I was going to do that. Not Tommy Kirk from Disney, Tommy Cook. But he's always holding that gun almost like it's a security blanket, you know, and you know, going back to that line that you're saying, this is, you know, where my peace of mind comes from. You know, I mean, clearly he's nothing without that gun. And one of the characters even says that at one point in the movie. And it's almost, you get this feel like he feels like he has to prove something, maybe because he's such a small guy. I don't know. But I thought that dynamic worked very well in this case.
Yes, it does. It does. And, you know, Tommy Cook was... He was Little Beaver some of the Red Ryder movies, and you know he was a child actor. Around the same time he did this, he was in Night Passage with Jimmy Stewart and Audie Murphy, which is a good 50s Western. And then later he ended up doing cartoon voices. He was a big cartoon voice guy. So, but yeah, I think he does. I mean, he's supposed to be, you know, the mad dog killer, and so, you know, he's a little over the top, but that's okay. Mm-hmm. Another interesting credit he has is, remember the movie Roller Coaster from like 77 or something?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He was one of the writers on that. So anyway, he had a long movie career, or movie and TV career, I guess you'd say. But
well, the exact opposite of that, I guess, would be Molly McCart, because I mean, I didn't see a whole lot of credits, you know, and I was like, that's a shame, because for me, she's the MVP in this film. Yep. I thought she was really great. I mean,
I think
she's just got this great kind of attitude. I mean, right from the opening scene, the opening scene is all about her trying to hook this guy in this bar. And it's a great sequence, and she's really great in it. And she's got this great look to her with the short hair. She's tough. She's pretty, but she's also this troubled character. I love there's that little moment where she falls asleep and she's dreaming and talking in her sleep and, you know, clearly hinting at some past trauma in her life. You know, and I thought that was a nice touch. Comes across as a bit of a tragic figure, but she goes along with Mike's antics.
The way she looks is perfect, because you know, the short hair and the way she dresses and everything gives her that attitude, but just something about her face. She's got this nice round baby face that kind of helps that idea that there's this tragedy, that she could have been something, you know, but instead of dirt, as Jane calls her. But so I think that whole thing, I mean, it really works well, but you're right. She is the crown of the film for sure.
I want to mention too, the scene that comes late in the movie where she and the son go out to the barn to get milk, and she basically tries to seduce him. It's another great scene, and, you know, really well written and performed. And yeah, and another one that really builds the tension of things.
Yeah, she did. And it's a shame she didn't do much, but she was also in, I think it's The Kiss Before Dying. She was in, that's one of the few, she did some TV, handful of TV shows, and then that was pretty much it. But that's a great scene. And I think that, you know, the guy that plays Ben, Frank Griffin, he does a great job, because his part, he is so stereotypical, you know, all American boy, and you don't want him to get killed. He's not. He somehow keeps him from being the most annoying thing ever. And so he does a good job. I mean, everybody does a good job. It's very well acted for what it is.
Well, there were a lot of surprising moments for me with Ben, just because it's kind of like what you were talking about before, where there's moments where you think the movie's going to go a certain way and it doesn't. I mean, like, you know, there's the scene where he, you know, sees an opportunity and grabs the candlestick and is going to try to bash Tommy Cook's character. And, you know, he doesn't end up doing it. You know, Jane ends up talking him out of it and all that stuff. And that would have seemed to me like, you know, well, that's an opportunity that someone like Sam Katzman would want to have in the movie. You want to stick, you know, this fight, you know, with a candlestick right in the middle of the movie. But he doesn't go that way. And I was like, that's a unique decision.
And I think that's what's good about it, is it was smart. I mean, they knew they didn't have a lot of money to do a lot of stuff. They didn't have a lot of time. So they kind of go for this slow burn, with these sort of scenes that build a little tension and let it off, and then, you know, build towards their finish. And it really works. I mean, this is one of those movies where you could say that, you know, almost everything they did works. I mean, there's not something where you go, well, they lost it right here. It really works. I think James Bell is really good as Mr. Grant.
I think
he was really good. And James Bell is always good. He's, you know, he was just one of those great 50s character actors. I think the weak thing in the film to me is Sue England.
I would agree.
I think it's her part more than anything. I mean, I kept, like I said earlier, I just kept thinking she's going to have her moment. You know, she's going to lose it and knock the crap out of somebody or something. But she never does.
I agree. I think, you know, the reason that's the weak spot is not so much the actress or the performance. It's because the script just kind of abandons her. And you know,
it does.
You think that, you know, eventually she's going to have her arc somewhere in this, and it doesn't happen. All the focus ends up being on the criminals, because let's face it, they're much more interesting.
Right. That's the whole thing, is I think they went where the interest was, and they're great. And so that part just, you know, was there stuff that got cut out? Was there, you know, who knows? She just isn't left with much to do. And so, you know, she could have come out as the hero, but it didn't work out that way. So that's kind of interesting.
Well, let's talk real quick about the ending here before we wrap this up. You know, we mentioned that it ends up taking place at Griffith Park Observatory. You know, they basically try to make their escape. The cops chase them. They've got hostages in tow, and they end up at Griffith Park Observatory. And we have this final showdown in the actual, I don't even know what you call the room, but it's the dome-shaped room where the telescopes are. You know, it spins and all this stuff. And I don't know. I liked it, but I'm going to fully admit it's a bit goofy.
It is a bit goofy. It could have been done in a way to build a little bit more tension. To me, I just was really – I kind of, like, stopped paying attention to go, oh, so that's how that works. You know, I was, like, watching the telescope around, watching the little doors open and stuff. That was cool, because you don't usually see it that way. You know, you just see the outside and you know, that's pretty much it. But this was kind of, oh, cool. I've never seen it like this.
Well, and it's shot in a cool way, too. I mean, like, yeah. You know, I liked that they're up there fighting and you see the window behind them. And, of course, the dome is spinning, so you get different, you know, angles of the city behind them. You see at one point the thing turns and you can see the cops running up the walkway. I was like, okay, right. Well, that's cool.
And what, I don't know how they got permission to do that, how much money they had to get, whatever. But that was production values that they could not have gotten any other way. Mm-hmm. You know, that's just great. You know, you just go there and you shoot on location for an afternoon or whatever. And, you know, you got something that nobody else has. And that's great. I just love that when B-movies will find a way to do something that kind of gives them something nobody else has. And that's just perfect. I think it's cool. It could have been handled a little bit better. I think that the end scene with Terry is really good. Molly McCart gets to really play.
Well, yeah. I was going to say, let's throw up the big spoiler warning here on this because we want to talk about the ultimate ending of things. I want to see how you feel about it because, yeah, we know a movie like this, the bad guys aren't going to win. Things are going to turn out bad for them. But things turn out especially bad for Terry because she ends up meeting the wrong side of a bullet. And she dies, but Tommy Cook, Mike, survives and is hauled off by the cops, wailing because she has died and all that. And I'm like, all right, it's, I guess, a good ending, but I'm like watching this whole film and the one that I want to see get what's coming to him is Tommy Cook. I wanted to see Terry survive. And, you know, I would have had that switched around.
I wanted to see him fall off the top of the observatory. That's what I
Thank you. Me too. Absolutely.
He's gonna fall through the slot and that would be it. But nope. And again, there we go again. It plays with what we think is going to happen. You know, I think that's something that is interesting is how, one, we learn the grammar of movies from watching movies. You know, we all kind of have this sense of, okay, they should cut away right here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we just learn how movies work. And then we also learn how, you know, all these plot lines, how they tend to play out. And so this is one of those that does something interesting by trying to avoid what you expect. And we all expected Tommy Cook to not make it. And we, like you and I just said, we expected him to fall to his death off the top of the observatory. And neither one of those happened.
Well, and you want to see a redemption moment for Terry because there's quite a few things in the movie that are leading up to that, where, you know, you get the sense at a certain point that she's maybe turning on Mike, right, and that she's gonna start doing the right thing here. And so to see her not have that ultimate moment of redemption at the end of the film and to end up being the one that dies, I mean, I guess maybe that plays into that whole concept of the cautionary tale, like we were talking about a few minutes ago.
Right. Well, I think, you know, I being a big Westerns fan, Westerns are all about redemption stories. Most of them are, right? And so that was one of the cool things about this is that you do think that, okay, there's something in there. You know, she's not all bad. There's something in there that got screwed over somewhere in her past. But there's a good person hiding in there. Tommy Cook, there's nothing but bad. I mean, he's just And so, again, you know, and if we're talking about, you know, she's this tragic character, and, you know, what's more tragic than you cash in your chips and your slimeball boyfriend survives? It, you know, poor girl never had a chance.
Yeah. All right. Well, we should take it to the break here. But any final thoughts you have on this one?
I could watch 547 movies just like this. I love cheap crime movies like this. I love them. And when they're done by somebody like Fred Sears, who, you know, gives them a little extra thing, then that's just the perfect sweet spot for me. I love these kinds of things.
Yeah, these movies certainly have a charm to them. This movie is not perfect. It's got its rough patches, but I think there's certainly a lot that is very entertaining about this one. So I had fun with it.
Yeah. It's not a, it's no Touch of Evil. it's no Outcast or anything like that, But it's just a cool little movie. I mean, I can't think of a better way to spend an hour and 15 minutes in front of the TV. I mean, that's and you know, I just love them. I grew up watching stuff like this, and I will go to, I will finish my days watching stuff like this.
All right. Well, let's take a quick break here. We're going to hear from another one of our podcasting friends, and then we'll be back with our movie recommendations here on the Forgotten Filmcast.
You'll save money and time. You'll get the best of merchandise and service when you patronize these good neighbors. Shop with them regularly for friendly service and money-saving values.
What do Raiders of the Lost Ark and the Treasure of the Sierra Madre have in common? What about Goldfinger and the Spy Who Came In from the Cold, the Blues Brothers, and Silence? There's only one way to find out, and that is to listen to Howard Kasner and Pop Art, the podcast where we find the art in pop culture and the pop culture in art. For each episode, my guest chooses a movie from pop culture, and I'll choose a film from the more art indie classic foreign side of cinema that has a connection to it. So for those who want to know about Jurassic Park and Frankenstein, Bride of Frankenstein, and Son of Frankenstein, tune into Pop Art on Apple iTunes, Spotify, Anchor, and other streaming platforms near you.
Hi, everybody. This is Todd. Just a reminder that you can help support this show through Patreon. For just a few bucks a month, you can support this show and earn access to some great bonus features, including a bunch of the older episodes of this show that are no longer available on the main podcast feed. Visit patreon.com/forgottenfilmcast to learn more.
Hey, Brenda, did you hear about that super shady secret organization?
Which one? The CIA? The KGB? The FBI?
Even worse, Rabbit Hole Podcasts. Brenda, I believe RHP is hiding proof of alien life, and I think you and I should uncover it.
Jason, that is too much work. Can we just watch the X-Files instead?
X-Files. Oh, yeah. I love that show with a teenager. Yeah.
Ooh, also, can I do updates?
Oh, like baseball updates? I guess. Just don't expect me to understand what the hell you're talking about.
Wonderful!
Check out the FBI's Most Unwanted and X-Files podcast on the 13th of every month, anywhere you get podcasts or its home location at rabbitholepodcast.com.
The updates are out there.
It's intermission time, folks, so hurry, hurry, hurry. Step right over to our refreshment center for the most extravagant array of refreshment goodies ever assembled under one roof. Enjoy breathtaking, mouth-watering goodies, everything from a snack to a delicious full meal. At our refreshment center, you'll find a large variety of goodies to satisfy your hunger, your thirst, or your sweet tooth. So hurry, hurry, hurry. Visit our refreshment center now.
All right, welcome back. It's time for our movie recommendations. This is the part of the show where each of us gets to talk about another movie that we've enjoyed, something we want everybody else to check out. It might be a forgotten film, might be an old classic, might be something new in theaters or on streaming. The possibilities are endless. So, Toby, what is your recommendation?
Well, if it's me, you know it's not going to be something new. Occasionally something in color. And this one is in color. I love to. There's movies that I grew up watching that I love, and I just can't learn enough about them. I just love to research them, and that's how my One-Eyed Jack's book came to be. And a movie that I have loved since I saw it when I was a kid at Christmas of 1977 was The Gauntlet with Clint Eastwood and Sandra Locke, and Eastwood had just done Outlaw Josey Wales. His direction was getting a lot of compliments and stuff. And then he goes and makes this thing, and everybody rags on him because the violence is real cartoonish and over the top. And why didn't they just shoot the tires out of the bus and all that kind of stuff? So it's a movie that got Eastwood had built up this credibility and then almost just trashed it with this movie. But I love this movie. It's really violent. It's just a road movie with Eastwood is a cop who goes to Las Vegas to extradite a witness for a trial, who's a prostitute played by Sandra Locke. And she is wanted dead by the mafia. And so all the way back to Phoenix, they've got one person after another, or one group after another, the mob and crooked cops and who knows who what else after them, until at the end they hijack a bus, build a metal turret or whatever you want to call it inside, and drive through the streets of Phoenix with cops on either side shooting the bus full of thousands and thousands of holes, but they don't ever put holes in the tires. And it's a goofy movie, and I love it, and I have always loved it. And in another week or so, I'm going to have a little book about it out. And when you write a book about a movie, you watch it 750 times. And so lately I have been wallowing in The Gauntlet. And so that is my recommendation. If you haven't seen it in a long time, watch it again. You might be surprised. There's more to it than you remembered. And what I find really interesting about it is that back in 1977, Eastwood was kind of predicting the future. You know, this is what action movies were going to be like, that they were big and loud and cartoonish, and that you needed to bring a, you know, you had to bring a very large suspension of disbelief with you in order to appreciate it. And I think, so when you look at it now, you don't have the problems with it that people did back in 77, because you've been taught to not think about things like this. I mean, how many times in those Fast and Furious movies would the tires have busted? And so it's just a good, I just like it anyway. So no, I'm not really making apologies for it. It's just a movie I like. And so watch it. And if you like it, there's going to be a book about it out there.
I will admit, this is actually a blind spot for me for Eastwood. I have not seen The Gauntlet yet, so I need to remedy that. Sounds like I'm in for a trip for sure. So.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I saw it when I was 13 years old, and I had not seen anything like it. I had not heard such language in a movie. And so, I mean, I was shocked. And my mom was really mad when my dad got home and we had seen it. So maybe that's why I like it so much. But anyway, it's just an interesting little movie. Well, and it was originally supposed to star Marlon Brando and Barbara Streisand, but it ended up with Clint Eastwood and Sandra Locke.
That would have been very different, I'm sure.
Very different.
Well, for my recommendation, I'm going to go with another 50s teen crime film. And I admit, it's kind of only a partial recommendation, because this is a film where there are parts of it that I think work really well and others that are a bit more run of the mill. So it's pretty uneven, but the parts that work well are the ones that focus on the lead character, this young criminal character. And the reason it is something to check out is because the actor playing this character is someone who would go on to be a big, big star. And this was their first film. The star is Jack Nicholson, and the film is 1958's The Crybaby Killer.
Oh, good one.
Which is produced by Roger Corman, who, of course, would go on to use Nicholson several more times. But Nicholson is basically a young troublemaker who ends up at the center of a hostage situation. Nicholson is pretty green here, but he stands out over everyone else in the film. I mean, you can just tell watching this, you go, that kid has got something. And, it just, the scenes that focus on him are really engaging. And that is, almost 100% because of Nicholson himself. The film does, I think, falter a bit because eventually it spends too much time focusing on the cops when you really want the film to get back to Nicholson. So right. I think that's kind of one of the downsides of it. But I mean, it's also a film that I think has some interesting things to say about people's fascination with crime and violence. But ultimately, the film's not too terribly deep. I mean, it's a Roger Corman movie, but it's an interesting curiosity more than anything, primarily because it's Nicholson's debut. Also because of the female lead in the film, Carolyn Mitchell, who would later be one of the many Mrs. Mickey Rooney's and eventually was killed in a bizarre murder suicide. That is one of those true crime Hollywood stories that people that love that kind of stuff go nuts for. So, there's a number of different levels that people kind of would be curious about this movie because of the cast. But you know, it's not the greatest movie, but I think it's an interesting watch. And like many of these B crime films from the 50s, you know, you can knock this one out in a little over an hour.
Yeah, it's like it's like an hour and 10 minutes or something like that. And it was written by Leo Gordon, the character actor, and his wife, Lynn Cartwright, is in it. But Leo Gordon himself is not in it, which is odd. But that's a really good movie. I really like that one. And it would make a great double feature with Teenage Crime Wave if you wanted to. Two 70-minute crime pictures. That one was from 58, right?
Yeah.
That's a good one.
All right. I want to thank you for being on the show. Before I let you go here, please remind everybody of where they can find you and all the different projects you got going on out there.
All right. There's my Westerns blog, 50swesterns.com. There's the Hannibal 8, which is a WordPress blog. And then there's my One Eye Jacks book, which has been out for a few years. And now there's the Gauntlet book, which is called A Look at the Gauntlet, which will be out in, a week, 10 days, somewhere in there. Just looked at the final on the cover today. So it's getting there. And so that's pretty much it. And, you know, you pick up a DVD, you might see my name on the back of it. I wouldn't buy it for that reason, but if you've already got it might be worth checking it out. So, you know, I just show up every once in a while. It's kind of weird, but that's it. That's me.
All right. Awesome. Well, thanks again for being on the show, and I'll be back to close things here in just a moment here on the Forgotten Film Cast.
Thanks for having me, Todd. I appreciate it.
Well, folks, that does it for this episode of the Forgotten Film Cast. Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to read more reviews of Forgotten Films, you can find them over at the Forgotten Films blog. That's at forgottenfilmcast.wordpress.com. You can follow me on X, the artist formerly known as Twitter, at Forgotten Films. That's films with a Z. And you can like Forgotten Films at Facebook. I welcome your questions, comments, and feedback about the show. So please email me at forgottenfilmcast@gmail.com. And while you're at it, think about leaving us a positive review over at iTunes or wherever you listen to this podcast. And then don't forget to check out our Patreon page, patreon.com/forgottenfilmcast, where you can learn all about how you can help support this show. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you again real soon.
Never touch you.
This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.